Welcome to Inclusion Bites, your sanctuary for bold conversations that spark change. I'm Joanne Lockwood, your guide on this journey of exploration into the heart of inclusion, belonging, and societal transformation. Ever wondered what it truly takes to create a world where everyone not only belongs, but thrives? You're not alone. Join me as we uncover the unseen, challenge the status quo, and share stories that resonate deep within. Ready to dive in? Whether you're sipping your morning coffee or winding down after a long day, let's connect, reflect, and inspire action together. Don't forget, you can be part of the conversation too. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seechangehappen.co.uk to share your insights or to join me on the show. So adjust your earbuds and settle in. It's time to ignite the spark of inclusion with Inclusion Bites. And today is episode 123 with the title Cultural Intelligence for Harnessing Diversity. And I have the absolute honour and privilege to welcome Ritika Wadhwa. Ritika is an ethnic minority, immigrant, female founder, and CEO of Prabhav Global, that specialises in using the transformative power of cultural intelligence for impactful leadership. When I asked Ritika to describe her superpower, she said, resilience. Hello, Ritika. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Joanne. The honour is absolutely, completely, and 100% mine. You know what a big fangirl I am of Joanne Lockwood.
Oh, got all bashful now. And we met each other recently at a Professional Speaking Association meeting, but also we caught up at the Cultural Pioneer Awards, didn't we, with HR Zone and SIFT. That was a great evening, wasn't it?
It was. I think I've been fangirling you from afar for a while. And so it was, I've actually seen you in a lot of forums, but obviously you only noticed me at the PSA first and then at the HR Zone. So I think our paths have crossed several times before that. And so meeting you in person was brilliant, but also being asked to be featured as a guest on your podcast is an absolute honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Ritika, then, tell me, cultural intelligence, how do we harness it for diversity? Tell us more about CQ.
Ooh, right. So where do I start? Tell us more about CQ. CQ is cultural intelligence. Cultural intelligence technically is defined as the ability to work with people that are different from us. It is a capability that we can all build and scale, very much like emotional intelligence. And it helps us to work in multicultural situations, to work with people that are different from us, to work and navigate situations that might not be familiar to us. There's IQ, there's EQ, and there's CQ. CQ is relatively the new baby on the block, as we call it, because it's been around 20 plus years, but only in the last 12 or so years has there been a practical application to cultural intelligence. Cultural intelligence, very much like emotional intelligence, is formed of four capabilities. The first capability is the CQ drive, the why. There's CQ knowledge, the what. CQ strategy, the how. And CQ action, when you actually do something about all those capabilities. And so what cultural intelligence does is hold people accountable, hold leaders accountable for behavior change. Because I've seen a lot of frameworks, very, very interested in the field of diversity, equity, inclusion, personally and professionally. And what I was most interested in is to hold people, leaders more specifically, accountable from moving from intent to impact. And this is the framework that I thought absolutely does that, because a lot of training courses out there and a lot of forms of intelligence, whether that's cultural competency, cultural awareness, whatever you want to call it, sit in the CQ knowledge box where you get the information, but you're not really told what to do with it. For example, unconscious bias training increases discrimination, yeah, because we're not taught what to do with that unconscious bias. And this is why a cultural intelligence framework means you've got the CQ knowledge, but you're being taught on how to use that knowledge to plan for those interactions that are different, to be aware of how that interaction is going and to self-reflect on what about it worked or didn't. And we know that the best learning comes from that self-reflection, comes from sitting with the discomfort and asking yourself what went right or wrong. And last but not the least, I was really, really interested in exploring a body of thought, a framework, a theory, a research-based topic on how can people show up, how can leaders act in a way that is adaptable, act in a way that is inclusive, act in a way that they are able to work with those differences in how they show up as an ally, in how they show up as a leader, in how they show up as an inclusive leader. So really that in a nutshell is cultural intelligence.
In a nutshell. Yeah, I've studied CQ a fair bit, and I always think that, as you say, knowledge, you can have the desire to do well, but unless you've got that strategy, you're likely to be armed and dangerous. Little knowledge can obviously take you to the wrong direction. When you talked about intent and impact, I always think if we're not careful, our positive intent can actually be problematic and cause negative impact. So that's where we've got to really focus on the strategizing, how we contextualize what we've learned, isn't it?
Exactly that. And this is why the organization's name is Prabhav Global. And Prabhav means impact in Hindi. So as much as it's a bit of a tongue twister, when I started thinking about the name for my organization and I came up with the word Prabhav, a lot of people with the right intention said, why don't you call it what it is on the tin? And I said, call it what it is on the tin for who? For me, Prabhav impact is what speaks to me in my heart. And that's what I'm really, really interested in, that impact. Whether the intent is positive or negative, we can't see it. What we feel is the impact of those words and actions that turn the intent into impact. And so that's what I'm interested in, how to use a theory, a framework that is foolproof to convert that intent into positive impact.
When I talk to people, one of the biggest things, the barriers to inclusion is the fear of getting it wrong. Yeah. People are so worried. We live in this culture at the moment, a blame culture. We live in a culture where of wokeness and anti-wokeness and political divide and people pushing back and people having their privilege challenged. And people get really scared about saying or doing the wrong thing for fear of being called out on the internet or getting in the newspaper for the wrong reasons. So how can CQ, cultural intelligence, help us navigate through that fear?
Wow. I love that question. I want to answer that question with Martin Luther King's quote. People fail to get along because they fear each other. They fear each other because they don't know each other. They don't know each other because they have not communicated with each other. So in a nutshell, it's all about the communication. And this is where CQ comes in. It sits at the heart. Cultural intelligence is about communicating, but communicating for impact. So what I mean by that is, how do we understand what outcomes we want to drive from any interaction? And getting to the core of that, what outcome do I want from my interaction with Joanne when I see you for the first time or when I'm in a meeting with you? Now, what knowledge do I have about Joanne? Okay. And now how am I going to use this knowledge to get the outcome that I want? And so with that, what we mean is people fear each other because they don't know each other. And this fear sits at that. If we can level up and increase the knowledge about the communities, the groups, those parts of society that we're not familiar with, that we don't know much about, if we can find ways to gain knowledge, whether that's through books, listening to podcasts like yours, being out there, watching movies, having those conversations, getting to know the human behind those biases and assumptions that we might have, will that take away that fear to some extent so that, not that we are completely confident, but at least we can come from a place of curiosity? And so cultural intelligence can really help us. And for this, to answer your question in a little more long-winded way, I personally think that the why is really important. When people say that we fear and there's anti-woke, there's this, there's that, what is it that we want from our lives and from society and from our employees and those around us. When our why is clear, it's easier for us to navigate that path and to be more confident in those interactions than just come from a place of fear.
Yeah, I think you're so right. You talked about getting to know people. I think what happens sometimes in these debates that become unproductive, toxic, whichever word you like to use, we start to dehumanize, and we can see a history of dehumanizing language throughout the generations and centuries where the out group becomes labeled and stereotyped with some sort of dehumanized view. I'm good, I'm normal, but they're not, they're bad, they're different. And then you sort of associate those words. And we see a lot of this with using Donald Trump as an example, the way he refers to his challengers for the presidency. You know, the dehumanizing always puts a negative label in front of their name and things like this to try and turn people's heads or minds against somebody with that repetitive. I think we've seen that in many wars. We're seeing it happen in the Middle East at the moment, where two sides dehumanize each other. Once something is not human, it's far easier to discriminate or eradicate or exterminate.
It really is, isn't it? It really is, because if you don't have names, you don't have faces, it's a certain set of society or certain religion or certain way of doing things that I'm not familiar with, that's got to be wrong, because this is not how I do things. I mean, religion goes a big way. One of the biggest backlash I get is whenever I talk about religion. It divides, it feels to me that it divides more than any other facet of humanity. And so how do we navigate that? How do we continuously work within that system to ensure that individuals are treated as humans, that groups are treated as humans? And I personally think that the more I work within this field, the more I come across people that are culturally intelligent, I see them being able to do this effectively. But you've got to open up to the idea before you go down that road.
So the first step on this journey, as you say, was CQ Drive. And I think you're quite right. You said before that even comes your why, doesn't it? Because the why gives you the drive. So what gave you your why to embark on this journey of enlightenment, if you like?
Enlightenment, wow. Epiphany more like. Yes, absolutely. Only took me 25 years to get to where I am, right? When I say 25 years, 25 years of working life, you know, a lot longer before that. But what it really was is I want to share that actually from the time that I was born, and I was born in India, up until now, even today, it very much feels like systems were put in place for someone like me to have a very different experience. And so that right there is the why, because from the time that I was born as a woman, as a girl in a patriarchal India, 40 something years ago, to then moving to the UK and to Canada, where it became that I'm a woman of color, that I'm an immigrant, that I have a funny accent, that I'm fresh off the boat. So many other facets of me that really was not something that was chosen. I didn't choose to be born as a woman. I didn't choose to be born in the color of skin that I was born in. And I'm very proud of that, don't get me wrong. But then systems were put in place for someone like me to have a very different experience of life and what I was capable of achieving, right? And so I've had to fight that system. And this is why resilience is the superpower. I've had to fight that system from the day I was born until today. As an entrepreneur, I'm still fighting that system. And so that's the why, because I want to leave a legacy. I want to leave a legacy for those that look like me, for those that have no choices in the way they were born, where they were born, how they were born, all of those facets to where we don't have a choice. I don't want someone like me to waste, and I say waste, 20 something years of their life before they get to the full circle moment of, I'm really proud of who I am and I can achieve whatever I want to achieve. It's taken me 25 years of working in boardrooms where I made myself small. I made myself fit in. I made myself try to please powers that wouldn't be pleased no matter what I did, to now get to the point where it's like, no, you know what? Try and take away any part of my identity now. Try and question any part of my identity now. No. So it's that part of that legacy for those coming behind me, including my own two daughters. But equally, how that makes me feel, that why is very much, I haven't felt better about myself and the skin I'm in than now, which is when I've embraced that totality of my living experience and who I am. So the why really is that. And I'm driven into boardrooms and into conversations with senior leaders and challenge them to say, how are you making your organization, your team, the space you occupy inclusive for people like me? And that's the why.
Seems very reasonable. I think that's a great motivation to change the world one person at a time, or one mind at a time, or one
conversation at a time.
One conversation, yeah, whatever. I think people often get frustrated that they can't fix the world now. And that's the problem with it. Sometimes you feel like you're taking one step forward and not just two backwards, but sometimes five backwards. Because for every time you make a difference, you see another example of somewhere you need to make a difference somewhere else. And it's just watching the TV and turning the news on, listening to Question Time on the BBC, whatever it may be, and you see examples day in, day out, where people who should know better and should do better don't, for whatever reason. The political ends, I guess, without getting too political here. So how can we try and educate leaders in that way then? Because, you know, you've got to start, as you say, you start with the why, but the first bit is the drive, and then we're going to get the knowledge. How do people acquire that knowledge?
When I work with leaders, in fact, the workshop that I had even this morning is very much about, I know my why, but I'm going to have to unpack their why, because everyone's why is different. And unless you're clear about your why. Now, let's be honest here. If your why, if you're getting to work, and I'm talking about lots of corporates that I've worked in, you're coming to work because ROI is important to you, that profitability is important, cost savings is important. Sure, innovation is important. Sure, that's all fine. Let's admit it. Let's admit to that that's your why. Or that you want to, you've had an experience of someone you love dearly that has been marginalized, someone, you know, your own experience of being marginalized, whatever the reason, and you want to make the world a better place. If you are not clear about your why, you're not going to be able to persist on this journey that we call diversity and inclusion. So let's assume, for the sake of this conversation, that a CEO of a big multinational company, their why is ROI, okay? Their why is financial stability, profitability. Now, we've got to ask yourself, are you going to be able to get to that space without diversity and inclusion? And by that, we mean diversity, because it brings the unique perspective that you need for innovation, and inclusion, so that those that are there with unique perspectives are able to speak up and give those unique perspectives. Because if you're not going to do it, your competition is going to do it. So the business case for doing this, and I'm talking about leaders that are either heart-led or head-led, the business case for those head-led leaders is a no-brainer right now. CQ is a critical capability for navigating today's increasingly global and diverse business environment. It's so important that we made it one of our core behaviors at PwC. This is by the CEO of PwC a while ago, right? So that's the why. Now, how do we go about gaining knowledge? That's the easier part. You've understood your why. Which cultures do you interact with the most? And by culture, I mean gender, I mean nationality, I mean sexuality, I mean ability, I mean religion, everything that makes us who we are. Which cultures do you interact with the most as a leader? That onus is now up to you to get the knowledge about how those cultures are similar or different from the way you are. There's books to read, there's podcasts to listen to, there's conversations to be had. There's innumerable resources out there. There is no excuse for a leader now to say, I don't know about this, because we've got the internet. You've got social media. Who are you following on your social media feed that is vastly different from your lived experience? So how are you constantly learning and gaining that knowledge? How are you understanding about the cultural values of the team members that you work with on a regular basis? I've had so many instances from leaders that will say, But you know what? I've said to my team, challenge me at any time. I love feedback. That's the only way I can get better. And look, I'm opening up myself vulnerably to feedback at any point. I'm saying, have you understood who's reporting into you? Maybe they come from cultures that are high power distance or low power distance. High power distance. Hierarchy means a lot to them, which means they are not okay to challenge their boss or someone that's senior to them in the organization. So by saying that you want to be challenged doesn't mean you're really opening the platform for constructive dialogue. And so that CQ knowledge box sits in really getting under the skin of what you think is acceptable and familiar to you. And it might not be for others, but it isn't wrong. So how are you navigating that?
I think that's important what you say there. It's leaders who say that. It's the same to me as my door is always open. Hmm. It's a very passive form of communication. It's saying, it's your problem to come and talk to me. As a leader, it's our job to lean in, to reach out, to be active and deliberate about our allyship and our learning. And you say, if you think about power dynamics, not everybody is comfortable. Not everybody wants to say, I want to knock on your door and disturb you. It's only a little thing. Say, just that little and often, how's it going today? Is everything working all right? What's any blockers? Anything I can help with? How's the weekend? And just those conversations, become used to having conversations with people. I don't expect everyone to come to you. No. And you might be listening to this saying, well, I've got 30, 40, 50 people reporting to me. Mm. I can't do that with everybody. Well, you can. You can if you want to. Maybe not every day, but just gently cycle around, speak to people, talk to people, get the lowdown. If you hear someone's having some struggles, make a special effort. But yeah, just to sit back and say, my door's always open. Come find me. It's like,
I agree. I think, you know, even if you look, I mean, that concept of leadership, I'm a big fan of servant leadership. So I really believe that a title doesn't make a leader. It is about what the leader does with the title. So it's how do you how do you earn the respect of those that report into you? How do you earn their confidence? How do you earn their trust? And that to me is leadership, because that's what will get the best out of the people that work with you and for you. The other interesting element to this is that old school thought of leadership and the door is open, speak up, give me feedback, give me challenge. It all comes from a great place of intention for sure. But what's the next generation looking for? The next the millennials, those coming behind us, their understanding of leadership and how they want to be led is vastly different from the way the world has been working so far. So how are leaders adapting to that? And that's, again, where the heart of cultural intelligence sits.
So you spent the early part of your life in India. I'm just curious, and this is curiosity, how different was it for you to start again, effectively, in a new culture, a different majority faith, a different majority language, even the food, it's the television, everything is different. How does that feel to be someone embarking on this second part of their life or the next part of their journey? Is it exciting or is it daunting?
What a great question, Joanne. And, you know, I've thought about it in so many ways over so many years now. And I'm able to recalibrate it so differently from if you had asked me this question even 10 years ago. Okay. And I say this because now that I've done this work and I've spoken to so many people within this field of diversity, equity, inclusion, I have some amazing friends, my tribe, and really gone deep into what all of this means. When I first arrived in the UK, as much as it was daunting and it was actually not great, and that's a polite word to use, but I was grateful. At that point, even when people mocked my accent or the fact that when I arrived into this country, I had significant work experience in India. I had a university degree. I had a postgraduate degree, but I didn't get a job in this country. I just didn't. They refused to even look at my CV 25 something years ago. And I had to start after months of looking and hundreds of rejection letters. I started from scratch as a sales executive. Really, anyone that could have me would have me. And I was grateful. That is the result of post-colonization, that anything white the fact that I am in London, the fact that I can actually visit Buckingham Palace anytime I wanted. It was so ingrained in us that everything white is so good that just to be part, just to get a job and work with white people, I felt grateful. It was those years were almost, wow, I've got white friends and I can go spend time with them and, you know, send photographs to my family in India about these white friends I have. And I'm working with bosses who are white and I'm going to university with white people and my professor is white. And now I'm really like I'm in this culture where Christmas is celebrated and Buckingham Palace on the, you know, and Oxford is down the road and Cambridge is down the road. All these words and notions that we grew up with in India, where we were taught to be grateful to a great extent because the British came and built the railways. Okay. And so when you unpack that part of what does that all of that mean, as hard as it was, I was terribly grateful. And it was hard. It was hard. Absolutely everything that you've said, the language, as much as it's English, it's still different. And of course, I was asked more than anyone else, so your English is really good. The number of times that people said, wow, do you have TVs in India? Wow, your English is really good, considering I was taught the Queen's English in a Catholic school by priests and nuns. It is a dichotomy of sorts, really. And so those initial years were really hard because the weather was awful compared to India, right? It just gets dark at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. What the hell is that? I thought the apocalypse? No, go on, help me here, Johan. When the world is ending, what's the word for that?
Apocalypse.
That's it. Thank you.
Let's hope it doesn't happen.
It got dark at 3 o'clock. I was like, oh my God, no one ever told me that's what happened here. And so, and obviously, you know, having no friends, no family, it was really, really hard. But I was grateful. And so I got through it. And this is a different season now.
So I'm just trying to fathom what it feels like. I mean, it's bad enough going on holiday to a country that you've not been to before, trying to drive on a different side of the road, trying to. And as an English speaker, native, there's an expectation that the whole world speaks English. And when you go to a part of a country, I think I was in somewhere in Spain where off of the main track you go into a shop and nobody speaks English. You almost look horrified. How dare you not speak English? Because you kind of get, it's that privilege you're born with, though, isn't it? You're brought up in a world where of the majority being white, being English speaking, having a certain status and wealth, you do tend to breathe that oxygen where you think everybody has the same. And that's where some of the CQ, I guess, comes in, where we're having to recognize some of the lived experience and the fact that they don't have the same experiences as you, and that their attitudes, social attitudes are different. Maybe there's an imposter syndrome, maybe there's a limiting belief in there as well, or as you said, there's a kind of aspiration to be white. Yeah, it's really interesting to hear that. Yeah, I never imagined that white people would be held in such high esteem in India after the colonial years of what we did to the country as a British colony. You know.
Yeah, it's what you're fed, isn't it? It's what you're fed even after. It's the stories. I mean, obviously, I've gone into a much deeper dive into what all of that meant, the British to be in India. And we did learn, now that I'm here, I realize and understand that actually we learned more about the British Raj in India than those living here ever learned. So we know what happened with the partition. Obviously, we know what the Jallianwala Bagh massacre meant. That was part of our history books. We learned about all that. Yes, they did build the railways, but what happened with the famine? What happened with the stolen jewels and all the textiles and, you know, all of that? So we learned about that in school. And then it's been a journey as part of my work, really, to dig deeper into what that really meant. And having said that, so that was an interesting in-between period. In the 1970s, 1980s, 1990s, those 30, 40 years, just under the shadow of post-colonial India, right? Now, if I look at India, when I go back now and I talk to those that are my age or younger than me, it's a very different narrative. Because India economically is doing better than the UK right now. So considering we've had 75 years of independence, so it's really a 75-year-old country in a sense, and you know, it's doing better economically. And so a lot of my body of work that I'm doing right now is focused on working with organizations that have a huge Indian employee base or offices in India. And this isn't about training Indians to work with the Western world. I'm taking the onus to actually train the Western world on how to work with India. Because guess what? You need it now more than they need it. And I mean the Western world. Yeah. US, Canada, Australia, all of these countries need to understand the culture of countries like India, like China, like Brazil, those countries that are overtaking, that are not buying, you know, oil in dollars. India's not buying oil in dollars right now. So what does that really mean? Do you need them more or do they need you? I think history has turned its head. Things have turned around completely. And so a lot of my work sits around understanding those Indian cultural values and how can you make the most of your employees there rather than teaching them how to order food in a British pub. Things have changed.
Yeah, I mean, it's a real shift, isn't it, in the power base, because the Western world wanted to use cheap labor, cheap resources, less controls, less health and safety, more, less worry about the environment, let's push all our problems out somewhere else. And the side effect of that was, yes, we probably didn't do great by the people, but we've actually created industries and knowledge and expertise that the Western world no longer has. We can't manufacture, we can't develop, we don't have the tech skills that you have in India and in China, or the rapid resources you have to be able to pull stuff together and people, and the growth that you have over there is phenomenal. And you know, I think, I'm not sure exactly where the rankings are, but China and India, the highest populations in the world, more people India in those two countries than most of the world.
I mean, yeah, so India is the biggest democracy, the most populated, with the average age being 23, and just rapidly developing in every way.
Yeah. Yeah, you can see where the power base is going to be in 2021 and onwards, if not before. So yeah, it's as a Western world person, I guess I need to be thinking about where the future is. I mean, fortunately, I'm probably too old to worry about it. But if you're coming out of school now, then sure as anything that India and China are going to be instrumental in the world economics in the
organizations. I'm working with a lot of multinational law firms, insurance firms, facilities management firms, name it, all these international firms that are looking to expand and have already expanded in places like Dubai and Bombay, you know, Hong Kong, Singapore, China, all these places. Literally, those are the organizations I'm working with, because they are coming to me and going, tell us how we can improve our knowledge. How can we use strategy? How can we, the drive is already there. It's a no-brainer for them. So I don't have to work on that, but I'm helping them to work and develop the rest of the capabilities. That is, it's almost as if literally, if you don't harness that diversity, if you don't harness that understanding and that knowledge, forget thriving, you won't even survive in 5 years' time. I'm not saying 20 years, I'm saying 5 years' time. If you're not harnessing that diversity, if you're not understanding how to work better with the East, if you're not understanding what your competitive edge is, and this is one of them, then really, that's what they're worried about. And that's why they come and come to me and organizations like myself to do this work.
Is English going to be the dominant language? Are people from the Indian subcontinent, are they going to be happy communicating in English, or will we see a shift in Western world people learn to speak different languages?
Joanne, I can only speak for India, and it breaks my heart. Really, it does, because that colonialism has left such a deep impact. And I say I speak only for India, but I've had these conversations with lots of people from countries that were colonized. And those marks of anything English, when I go back to India now, a lot of my friends only speak to their children in English. all the education system worth anything is in English because of that colonialism to go, if you don't learn English, if you don't understand English, if you're not ahead in English, we won't get ahead in life. Whereas if I go to countries like Greece and Spain and Italy, where they're not shy about their language, they're not embarrassed. All their education system is in the primary home country language. So it is, I mean, in Greece, it's Greek. In Spain, it's Spanish. You know, so there's that aspect of that. But equally, the other aspect about India specifically that I can speak with is that it's so diverse, even internally. We've got 26 something states, and every state has its own language, that the only way to bind the country continues to remain to be English. So Hindi is the national language, but a lot of the north is Hindi and a lot of the south still speaks in English. They have 99% literacy rate in some states and it's all English education. So really, in that sense, literally, you talk to the rickshaw drivers, you talk to the vegetable vendors on the street, you talk to it, everybody speaks in English. Everybody speaks in English. And this is why I'm, I try to teach Hindi to my girls and they learned it. They knew and they spoke Hindi fluently until the age of 4 or 5, until they started school. And then they go to India and they talk to Indians and everyone's speaking to them in English. So the effort is just gone. And so, yeah, long-winded answer to the fact that it is sad, but I do think that English is there to stay as far as India goes.
It also means if you are trying to communicate with people in other countries, you mentioned Greece and Spain and other places, that you can probably communicate in English more readily in more countries. And it's become kind of like the universal standard language, isn't it? The official second language or the official third language of many countries. And it's unusual not to find English spoken in many countries these days.
But also that's also why India is on such a rise, because unlike a lot of other nations, India's ability to grasp language and English being its primary language, but also Indians will generally keep their head down, work hard, get on with it. It's a combination of all of these factors, which is also why if you look at Silicon Valley, most of the CEOs are Indian origin.
So you mentioned that India, did you say 26 states? You said, is it 26?
Yeah.
And each one of those, it has its own culture. And as you say, sometimes in terms of different languages and different, and it's run sort of semi-autonomously within the overall sort of state. That means that I, as a person who wants to maybe do business in India, it's not just doing business in India, it's doing business in a city or this city. And that's it. The culture is going to be different. So the CQ knowledge I need, it's going to be different amongst different parts. So I'm not just learning about India, whereas in the UK, you tend to learn about the UK. And yes, we have a north and a south and Scotland and Wales, but we're not vastly different. But what you're saying implies to me that there is a huge difference culturally.
Correct. So just to correct, it's 28 states. Yeah. Technically, now that we've gone back to 28 states in India, and absolutely every state has its own language, its food, its culture, etc. So interestingly, this is the conversation that I have with a lot of leaders as we work through cultural intelligence. What it is that it's impossible. Take India for an example, 28 states, whatever different languages. But look at the world around us and how many languages are spoken and how many cultures there are when you look at religion, ethnicity, nationality, all of that. It's impossible for us to know everything about everything. What cultural intelligence does is it helps us become flexible and adaptable to work with any difference. So I might know generically that, okay, India is a high power distance culture, or that this is the language spoken there, this is the food that's generally eaten. I know generally, and that onus is up to me to get that general knowledge, plenty out there to get that. I've gotten the general knowledge. When I actually go and work with people in that country, what I'm doing is I'm using the strategic part of the capability to go, okay, so I know that in India, generally people are hierarchical, that the culture works in a way that there's respect for titles, there's some formality there, etc. However, I'm sat in this meeting with an Indian person in Mumbai, but they seem to be low power distance. They don't really care about hierarchy. They don't really care about titles. So I'm going to flex and adapt the way I am conducting this meeting to get the outcome that I want. And that is cultural intelligence. So if you don't have the knowledge, you will go in through your own, you will go in using your own cultural lens. So having the knowledge is really, really important. It's not a, it's really important to gain as much knowledge as we can about the cultures that we work with. However, that's where if knowledge is all we have, as you've pointed out in the start, if knowledge is all we have, then that leads to stereotyping. But cultural intelligence holds you accountable to using that knowledge to flex and adapt in the here and now. So as much as I've got the knowledge, I'm sitting with someone that does not subscribe to any of the knowledge that I have about this culture. So how am I going to flex and adapt? And this is the beauty of the framework, where really it is about how we work with any difference, and it's impossible for us to know everything about everything.
Yeah, you can't have a check sheet or a manual for every individual person. You have to, as you said right at the beginning, we talked about emotional intelligence, EQ and CQ, you blend them together. And when you're meeting people who are unknown for the first time, using a certain set of skills, a blend between those two, you can start to build relationships. But if you go in there with assumptions, go in there without paving the way, if you like, for that conversation, you're going to get it wrong. So what are the kind of typical mistakes that Western, Northern Hemisphere, Western world people tend to make in terms of the assumptions, or when working with people in maybe in the Southern Hemisphere continents?
Lots, lots, but that's again down to the individual in the way they have been brought up, in what knowledge they've been accruing and through which sources. So it's very, again, very individual, really. So I'm not sure if I would paint it with a wide brush of Western way. But generally, I would say, you know, an example of that general way is that somebody shared with me, a white man who shared with me recently, that he's a senior trainer within an organization. And he was sent to Malaysia with the specific purpose of training Malaysian women to become more assertive. I mean, where do you start from that, right? It's just, what does assertiveness mean? In what context? How is it expressed? And why is it that if it's expressed differently, that's not okay, and that you need training? Why is it that women generally get training and confidence? Why? I mean, what is the benchmark of how confidence is expressed? Who decides? So every juncture, it's not just East and West, but I'm thinking everything that is the dominant way of doing things isn't necessarily the only way of doing things. And I think especially those coming from the West, when they work with those in the East, have to question every assumption that, do I think this person is not being assertive because my version of assertiveness looks different? Do I think that this person is not challenging me enough because my view of what challenging means is different? Do I feel like this person is being disrespectful because my view of respect is different? Do I feel like somebody else has recently mentioned to me that that they got really irate with loud people, and they considered that culture really loud and found it difficult to work? Loud by whose standards? So all of those assumptions, when you have privilege, and I mean everybody has some privilege, when you are privileged in certain facets, those are the facets that you feel are the dominant features. And that's not really how the rest of the world operates. So you've got to question every facet of the privilege that makes it a dominant feature. Does that make sense?
So I think what we're trying to do is assimilate people to behave as I behave. That's what we're saying. You know, you don't meet my model of assertiveness, you don't meet my model of the way you speak your language, the way you interact with me. I want you to make it easier for me to deal with you. That I'm pushing that back to you then, aren't I? I'm training you to be a better me, not training me to be more receptive to your needs. And again, that's what we talked about, the leadership being passive, not active. How can I reach out in a way that's respectful to you, not expecting you to be respectful to me? And I have to be responsible for my change as well, don't I?
Absolutely love that, Joanne. I don't know anyone who summarized this whole thing that I've just shared so wonderfully. That's exactly that. And those that do come from dominant groups are so used to the world molding around them that it's hard to step out from that comfort and go, how do we change this? And it's hard, but equally you've got to ask yourself, why do I need to change this now? The answers are overwhelmingly that if you don't, then you won't survive, let alone thrive. Someone said, whatever it is that got me here is not enough to keep me here. And so there you go.
Yeah, we're constantly refining our why, aren't we? Our motivations, what makes us happy, what makes us sad. We need to be stretched, not always. We need to relax occasionally, but we need to feel that we're growing. Because if we're not growing, we are going backwards. And that's the challenge, isn't it? And people are coming behind us and around us, organizations, leaders. So we have to keep pace. I think we can get complacent. You feel like you've got to the top of the hill, but you don't realize there's still another hill that you haven't quite climbed yet. It's probably still in the cloud. You don't even know it's there until you walk to the bottom of it.
Yep.
You mentioned, I'm really curious, as we're having this conversation, you mentioned about the partition. Mm. I know very little about that. As you quite rightly said, we very rarely learn about the history of our colonial dependencies, for want of a better way of describing the places we invaded and took all their wealth and left them with religion and railroads. From my understanding, it was done on almost, was it religious, basically, norms, where mainly the Muslim population of India were forcibly ejected into Pakistan to be a Muslim state, whereas India remained a Hindu Sikh state. Was that kind of the rough? And it was a very, very tough time for everybody. Forcibly ejected, weren't they? And there was no kind of negotiation. It's off you go.
Yeah, I mean, one of the we learned about it a lot at school when I was growing up. But you know, when you're at school, you're like memorizing it to answer the exam paper, and that's that to that. And then you get to a certain point in your life where you look back at your roots and your foundations and what all of that meant. So someone recommended a podcast called Empire. And I have studied that. Oh, my God. That's one of the best versions of really neutrally explaining what happened with the British Raj and what they did and why they did and all those massacres and all the wars and the reasons behind that and what happened at the House of Lords here, you know, all of that goes into the history of it. And in a nutshell, the way the British worked across pretty much all the empires and countries that they colonized was on the policy of divide and rule. So as soon as they saw groups of rebels or groups getting together, getting along, forming some sort of a contingent to rebel against that power, they would divide and then continue to rule. And so actually the Hindus and Muslims got along swimmingly well, wonderfully well. They were neighbors. It was all one country. Religion was never an issue until, of course, then the British were almost forced to leave because, you know, Gandhi did the nonviolent movement and all of that part. And as they were leaving, of course, they wanted to leave a hue of destruction behind them. So literally, one person took the map of that was all of India and drew a line across it, going through farms and railway tracks and people's properties and all of that, and go, this is Pakistan, this is India. And they created that animosity in the Muslim leaders' minds against the Hindu leaders and vice versa, which then led to this awfulness that was partition, where actually my granddad was born in Lahore, the other side, which is Pakistan now. And he was one of them that actually took his belongings or whatever it was, got on the train and got to India and saved his skin, and pretty much still got a village there where my granddad and his brothers and all of them, just a little bit this shy of Pakistan. You could walk across the border. That's how close they settled themselves there. And millions dead. And even today, it goes on with Kashmir being a big issue around whether that's part of India, whether that's part of Pakistan. You've got the line of control and Hindus and Muslims still don't get along, you know, and all of that still happening 75 years you know, very much like what I wouldn't compare it completely, but what's going on with Israel and Palestine. And that's part of exactly, we're really sorry what happened in Europe. Here you go. So all of those are parts of that legacy where it's really sad.
Yeah, it is. And it's been quite a privilege to ask you that question and hear for my own education, because, you know, I've got the drive and I want the knowledge. It's making sure that we take opportunities when we're meeting people, not just to ask about you as an individual, but also some of your cultural heritage as well, so I can be better understanding. And hopefully next time I meet someone who has maybe come from the Indian continent, then maybe I'll have a bit more conversation. Next time I meet someone from Pakistan, I'll have a bit more empathy with the history of the country. And we've got to take opportunities to be curious, haven't we? And I think that's so important to, otherwise we just live in our bubble.
It's easier to do that, though. You'll be surprised when I work with leaders on cultural intelligence, the number of people that are happy the way they are. And that's fine. As in, what I mean by happy the way they are is that they're not that curious. They're not that motivated to get on a train and go to some distant land and eat in the local restaurant there or travel by the local bus. And that's fine, because it's easier to work with people that are just like us. It's easier to be around. You don't have to do the guesswork around what did that mean when they were raising their hand like that, or when they were, you know, what were the non, all of that guesswork's taken away when you work with people that are just like you. So that sense of curiosity is not inherent in everybody. And the whole part of this work, which I find fascinating, is that you, even if you're not curious, you can become curious. So if your CQ drive scores are really low, there are very specific strategies and ways that you can increase that CQ drive and become curious and want to embark on those experiences. Because guess what? Again, if you don't do it, that if you don't embark on that, if you don't stay curious, if you don't find out more, where are you going to end up?
Yeah, I suppose I've had a privilege of working all over the world. When I worked for a bank, maybe not for huge amounts of time, maybe 2 or 3 weeks at a time. I worked in Zurich, best part of about 18 months on and off. So 3 or 4 weeks here, 3 or 4 weeks there. So I was spending a lot of time in Zurich. And also I've been members of organizations that have a global reach, global footprint. And I've stayed in people's houses, home hosting around the world, all across Europe, all across North America. So I've had the opportunity that I'm now part of a global association of speakers, where I'm not just meeting people who are living in the UK. I'm meeting people who are still living and working and thriving in their country. And so I actually see people in their home environment, and it's a real privilege to. So that I suppose that's where it's not even a drive. It's just the normality for me, where people are really curious. And about 5 years ago, I spoke at a conference in Kyiv in Ukraine. It was almost five years ago this month. And I remember walking around the square in the middle of Kyiv, where there were snipers on the rooftops. I can't remember the year. I think it was like 2014, 2015, where they were shooting and they killed 99 people or something like that. And if you go to, I think it's Revolution Square, and there's memorials to these people. And something you said earlier was quite powerful, reminded me of this, was in order to humanize that loss, every little memorial has a photograph, has a story. So when you're walking around there, you know who person A was, person B, because you've got their story in front of you. The relatives still bring things to that space. And I also remember visiting Cyprus, and on the border between the Greek side and the Turkish side, there's a border there, the no man's land. And on the Cypriot side that I was at, you could see the photographs of the children that had been lost, disappeared, wherever they may be, either killed or kidnapped or just partitioned and separated. And again, by having those faces and those stories, humanizes the conflict again. I think sometimes it's hard to watch the news, and there's been stories around the Middle East. We're seeing real stories about people who've lost their lives, the devastation of the people there. And to see those faces, to hear those stories, is the powerful element that keeps us human and means that we've got to do something. So I guess that's kind of my why, is to humanize,
yeah.
is to don't yeah. allow us to fall into that way where we can demonize, dehumanize, and treat people as sub something. And I guess that's my why. It's
interesting though, because, you know, again, if you're completely privileged and you haven't ever felt what it's like to be marginalized, discriminated, bullied, harassed, hurt, or that people you love have been hurt because of just who they are, then it's so hard to stay curious or want to do something about it. I personally do think very strongly, and right or wrong, that this work of dehumanizing, or this work of activism, you might call it that, or this work of just wanting to make the world a better place, can come only when it sits deep in the gut, when it's really, really, really personal to you. And as much as, you know, for example, my girls come across as, you know, they're presumed white. They're 100% presumed white. So the way the doors open up for them, very different from my own lived experience. But I make sure that they know that their mother has not had the same experience that they are having. Of course, the fact that they are in England compared to I was being brought up in India, patriarchal India at that, post-colonial India at that, that's different. But, you know, even when we are traveling together at the airport, if I'm treated differently, they need to know that. And that's what will keep them wanting to fight towards an equitable world, because their mother had to fight the system. And unless it becomes personal, I don't think people will have the fire in the belly to be persistent, to continue when the going gets tough.
Yeah. Oh, that must be really, I was going to say interesting. I mean, interesting is not the right word. I'll explain what I mean. So you have a live, real example of being able to compare and contrast your lived experience with those of your daughters based on perceived ethnicity. I'd say interesting is the wrong word. I can't think of the word I'm trying to find here, but it must be you're able to observe that firsthand about those differences, and you're obviously happy for your daughters, but sad that it came at the expense of their culture, faith, and history.
Mm.
They've almost had to have that part of them erased. I'm now acceptable because I'm white, kind of thing.
Right. And I don't allow them to erase that. I don't allow it. I let them know. My now 6-year-old knew from the time that she started school at 4 that she is presumed white. She knows the word. She knows what that means. So we can just do our bit. But the very fact that I'm out and about speaking to humans that are 16-year-old and those that are 66-year-olds about this exact same topic in the simplest terms, to go, "Mommy, what do you do?" And I'm like, I just try to get people to be kind to each other. That's what I do. I just get out there in the world to do that. Why? Because, you know, they weren't kind to me because of the way I look. How do you feel about that? How do you feel about your best friend being treated differently just because they have a darker color skin compared to you? Or look out for the person that is alone in the playground. I mean, that's all we can do, right? And so that's the part of the legacy, which is a live thing that we are constantly working with.
You had to give our listener here a way to find their why and their drive. How would you suggest that they inwardly reflect to find that why where they don't have it?
Interesting. So two things on the fly, I'm going to answer that. Two things. One is, think about the time that someone you love was treated unfairly. How did that feel? Really, how did that feel? And now project that to the world around you. How does every person who's marginalized, how do they feel when they've constantly got a glass ceiling in front of them, that they're told they're not capable of doing something because they're differently abled, or because they have a different sexual orientation, or because they look different, whatever it is? You've got to, that feeling, you know, deep in your gut, that's the thing that I urge leaders to find. Secondly, whatever it is that gets you up in the morning and doing whatever it is that you do, what is that? What is that? We're all living not because we're a robot, but because we want to achieve something, no? When we're all at our deathbed, what did we achieve? We all want to, whether that's providing for our family, whether that's leaving a mark because we made the world a better place, whether that's becoming really rich, like whatever it is, if you unpack that part, then that's that, that will lead to your why and how you can play your part in making the world a better place, because ultimately it all boils down to that.
What a fascinating conversation. How can people get hold of you and find out more?
I'm everywhere. Trust me. It's hard not to get hold of me. Yeah, no, on LinkedIn, Instagram, my website, Ritika Wadhwa on LinkedIn, Prabhav Global, the website, Prabhav Global on all socials. Yeah, it's hard not to find someone these days. So hopefully lots of people come looking for me. But I've thoroughly enjoyed this conversation, Joanne. It's been absolutely fascinating and very unique. I've loved it.
Thank you so much. As we bring this conversation to a close, I want to express my deepest gratitude to you, our listener, for lending your ear and heart to the cause of inclusion. If today's discussion struck a chord, consider subscribing to Inclusion Bites and become part of our ever-growing community, driving real change. Share this journey with friends, family, and colleagues. Let's amplify the voices that matter. Got thoughts, stories, or a vision to share? I'm all ears. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seachangehappen.co.uk and let's make your voice heard. Until next time, this is Joanne Lockwood, signing off with a promise to return with more enriching narratives that challenge, inspire, and unite us all. Here's to fostering a more inclusive world, one episode at a time. Catch you on the next bite.